Public Affairs. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2670. Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Starr, State Representative, House District 3, Western Washington County, testifying in support of House Bill 2670. This is a bill that deals with character education. It was a bill that we found in a committee that wasn't going to be acted on, and we did a little gutting stuff in House rules. Basically, what it does is it talks about the need for character in the state, has quite a few whereas clauses. Bottom line, what it does is it encourages school districts to educate their kids in character education. It names a specific criteria, a specific curriculum, character first education series. And the reason we did that, Mr. Chair, is we have some experience with that in the state of Oregon. The community of Classic and I has adopted basically that curriculum in whole as a whole community. The school district uses it. The newspaper in town has a character of the month, and they, you know, highlight that. The Chamber of Commerce as well has picked up on that and have encouraged in their businesses in that state or in that community, excuse me. Basically, we have some experience with a curriculum that has proven to be successful. And as you're aware, we have other communities around the nation that have also done similar things as Classic and I have in Oregon with this curriculum. Further, the curriculum must be, if they don't pick this particular one, it says they can have a similar program or a similar curriculum. And on Section 2, subparagraph 2, it has to be secular in nature. The whole idea here is, I worked with and talked to the School Works Association before we move forward on this, it's a permissive issue, it's not a mandate, which I'm not excited about any more mandates on our schools, but this is one where we recognize the importance of character education. We have a program, I think, that's a credible one that's proven success and like to recommend it to the school districts around the state. Further, Representative Beck from Northwest Portland presented an amendment to the bill in the House rules that encouraged, or actually it mandated to the Department of Education to apply for grants, for character education pilot project grants. And in fact, the state has done that already. And they have money that they've received in this grant process. And that's one of the reasons why you have some amendments before you, the B8 amendments. The reason the original bill said that they had to or would apply for those grants in the current binding, 9901 biennium. The problem with that is that they've already received grants. There's a 5-year time frame when once you get a grant, you can't get any more. And so since they've already gotten grants, I think it was in 98, we had to push that date out, and that's why the B8 amendment changed that date to 0305 binding. Further, there was some concern actually in the committee and on the House floor related to one of the specific whereas clauses that talks about single-parent families, and I agreed that it would probably worthwhile to just remove that whereas clause and that the dash B8 amendments also do that, just to maybe smooth this process. The whereas clauses, I think, are important, but they're not worth, you know, the trouble. And that was a major complaint on the House floor and why we had the no votes that we did, I believe. I think it's a good bill. Let Representative Lundquist staff here to talk about some additional amendments that were made to the bill to deal with some Eastern Oregon problems that they've had. But I would encourage the adoption of the SBA amendments, and I do pass and move the bill forward as quickly as possible.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jessica Harris, and I'm representing Representative Lynn Lundquist, District 59. I thank you for your time. I'm here to address Section 4 through 6 of the bill, which simply allow a district to claim In lieu of transportation costs, room and board costs, we reimburse at 70% as we do transportation costs for students that attend public boarding schools under an interdistrict agreement or through a power of attorney. Currently, those costs are not reimbursed, although we do currently allow in statute, if you're a resident of a district, say specifically Crane School District in clear out near Burns, those students are residents of that district because transportation costs would be so great to try and bus those students in and out of school every day, there's a public boarding school there. Those students claim, or the district claims, room and board costs as transportation costs for those students. This would say if there's students coming from out of the district into a district, but that stay at a public boarding school, those students would be eligible for transfer. They would receive room and board costs in lieu of transportation costs. It's a very important bill for Mitchell School District in particular, which is in Representative Lundquist District, as well as any other public boarding school. There's five of them in the state.
That's in section 4 and 5 of the bill. Then.
4, 5, and 6, yes.
4, 5, and 6. Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We
appreciate your help. Anyone else care to testify on the bill? If not, we're going to close public hearing. And on the House Bill 2670, and because we don't have committee yet, we're going to go on to public hearing. Oh, no. Let's see. Need the sound. Difficult when all your committee members are okay. I'm going to reopen the hearing on House Bill 2670, and we had a citizen travel from class and I had to test on the bill and had trouble finding the hearing room. Reopening the hearing on House Bill 2670. And Mr. Martin? Yes, sir. Have a seat and identify yourself for the record. We're discussing the Church First Education Bill. That's the bill you...
Yes, sir. That's it. My name is Steve Martin, and I'm here representing the City of Clatskanie, Oregon, the City Council and Chamber of Commerce, and the public school, and the character program that we've been utilizing for the past year, which this bill addresses to some degree. These materials were implemented at the beginning, the character materials that we used at Clatskanie were implemented at the beginning of the school year last year in a pilot project, and then we used that in 13 different classrooms throughout the second semester of the year. What brought that about was a proclamation by the City of Clatskanie to be a city of character, and this is just one arm of the city council, city government's leadership of how to make a difference in our community and hopefully our county and beyond that, our state, even our nation. And I have copies of all these materials I'm making reference to leave with you, sir. The proclamation came out by the City Council. They renewed that in 1999. The first one was in 98. And that's been advertised in the local newspapers. And this character focus that we've had has inconvenient for businesses, our law enforcement, our city government, our faith community, our schools, and our homes all to be a part of. And so it hasn't just been an education bill or an educational pursuit in the city of Clatskanie, but it's been more broad than that. We have 16 businesses that are promoting this among their employees, where employers are having a way of investing into their employees and making a difference in their lives, not just on the job, but at home as well. We have churches that are using this in pastoral ministry because the material is conducive to that if they'd like to use it, which brings a unity in the faith community. The schools is just one arm that this character program has been successful with. Clatskanie, we have been able to utilize our media. As a result of that, I have copies of that as well, of how the monthly character coffees come out in the newspaper, our county paper, as well as our local newspaper. Our local newspaper does feature articles on each of the qualities and has pictures of all the students coming together to hear character stories and character instances taught by volunteer coaches that come into the schools to assist in the classroom and in a large assembly. And then our newspaper editor has recognized character all-stars in the paper at the end of each month on the character qualities and studies, and has gone in and taken pictures, and the children all look forward to doing being one of those selected. The newsletter for the local school district has carried a favorable article as well. But probably the most important thing that would make a significant statement in this hearing is what the children have to say about the character that's been used. And since this is an educational bill, I thought maybe I could share some of their words to their character coaches that they've written themselves. And several notes have come over the year. This one says, "I like you coming to our school. You could stay here forever. I will always tell the truth, even if it will be hard." And that was from this young lady's friend called Randy. These are all from third grade classrooms I'll be reading today. Another said, "Dear character coach, thank you for your advice about being good to our friends. I wish I could be like you. Someday when I grow up, I will always be kind like you. I wish you could come here every day." The character coaches came into our schools twice a month for about 40 minutes on each day. And all of these reflect those same flavors. The students have been greatly influenced by these coaches. Here are some others that are from a different setting. The character trait I liked best was truthfulness. I liked it because it is about honesty. I liked the stories. They were good. I liked the songs on the piano. "I'm going to work on truthfulness. I will admit when I am wrong. Thank you. Have a good summer." And that was from a young man named Brandon. Another one from Autumn. "The character trait I liked most was virtue. I like it because the great story told me a lot, and I stand alone with, told me a lot, and I stand alone when everyone is doing something they shouldn't. The character trait I need to work on the next few months is orderliness, to pick up after myself more. I'm going to work on it much. Thanks, your friend Autumn." And all of these are just notes from students reflecting how these character qualities, which were nine that were taught to the students over the school year, have influenced the students. Along with that, in Clatskanie, the corporate or the businesses, they have a bulletin that they get as well. And these and the city employees are engaged in this, our law enforcement, the businesses. And so it's more, again, than just an educational program for us. It's truly an effort by our city to make character a cultural norm. And Clatskanie has been very successful at doing that. And what we've found, the key to that success is basically just the DNA. If we will demonstrate that before the students by bringing in positive role models and seeing parents influenced by that on their jobs and then coming home and talking about those character qualities and then naturalize it. In other words, that just becomes the natural thing to do, the normal thing to do is to have good character. And the way we cement that is just by acknowledging it. recognizing and praising the students for the character that they sing. The character All-Stars is one way that we've done that. We're going to be training high school students to teach, to come in and teach the children this coming school year out of our public high school there at Pasadena. And so the whole city's winning. And so we just want to give our voice to encourage the passage of this bill and the affirmation of it. It's a win-win situation. And what we're finding in Pasadena is when you put character first, character works. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Black Sabre. Thank you for taking the time to come here to testify. I was there kind of at the beginning of this. I was there in the school library in February of 96 after the flood.
Yes.
When Bill Gothard said, you work with me, I'll work with you. We'll make Pasadena a model for the Northwest.
Yes,
I believe you're on your way to doing that. And I commend you for the community's involvement. And it's really exciting to see that that this does work and it does help to make a community stand out. So I thank you again.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to close the public hearing again on House Bill 2670. And we've still not got a committee. I've got committee members in conference committees. That's, and here is...
We closed ours down. That one was a girl.
You closed yours down?
Right.
Well, we want to have a hearing on House Bill 2335, Senator Shannon.
Okay. Oh, we need to go get, did you get Senator Courtney, John? Is he in here? Yeah, he's sitting up there.
Open the public hearing on House Bill 2335. And we've only got...
Let me see what my amendment is. Okay. Which one's my amendment?
A9.
A9.
We have Helen Leary signed up to tell us about Amendment A9.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here today to talk about this bill and particularly to talk about school zone safety. My name is Helen Leary, and I'm the executive director of a nonprofit organization called the Alliance for Community Traffic Safety in Oregon. We are an organization that promotes traffic safety. That is our one and only mission. And in doing that, we work with groups throughout the state, and we work with traffic safety committees, health departments, fire departments, and others who are interested in promoting safety in their community. And so you might find us providing a mini grant for bicycle helmet distributions or working at bicycle rodeos or doing child safety seat checkup clinics, doing speed watch programs, and a whole host of programs throughout the state. The reason I mention this is that we take our direction entirely from local communities and local traffic safety committees, and they were the ones who said that school zones needed to have some work. As a result of that, we created a statewide task force that looked at school zones in a very comprehensive manner. And we had people representing law enforcement agencies, state and local and county engineers, pupil transportation, traffic safety committees, and others who were interested in this topic come together. And there were a whole host of problems identified about school zones, and we put together a host of recommendations that are being considered as policies and best practices by the Oregon Traffic Control Devices Committee. But the issue that needs legislation revolves around the lack of a clear definition of when children are present. Now, currently, you are supposed to go 20 miles per hour in the school zone when children are present. And the way that is defined is on any day and at any time when children are visible or can reasonably be expected to be visible. And what people throughout the state told us is the problem with this is that a youngster can be playing two football fields away behind a fenced school grounds and be visible from the road, and technically you are to go 20 miles per hour. In addition to that, the problem was trying to figure out, well, when could a child even reasonably be expected to be visible? So you had people thinking that if school was in session, they needed to go 20 miles per hour. And you had law enforcement and courts viewing this interpretation entirely differently. So we had reports of people receiving citations at 4 a.m. in the morning, of one car almost being rear-ended as they slowed down during school, but there were no children visible, and the driver behind them thinking that they didn't have to because there did not appear to be a situation where they needed to go 20 miles per hour. As a result of that, the amendment that is A9, that Senator Shannon has been kind enough to get written up for this, House Bill 2335, includes that definition of when children are present that this group in the task force felt would clarify it for drivers, for law enforcement, for the courts, and most important of all, for the safety of our children. It states very clearly that you are to go 20 miles per hour when children are in or at a crosswalk, in or alongside the road, or within 50 feet of the road on unfenced school grounds, so that now a driver, as they approach a school ground and a school zone, they will be able to look strictly around the area to see if children are there and slow down when they are the most vulnerable. And again, maintaining it on any day and at any time. We feel this definition, because it will add consistency and clarity, will increase safety for our children a great deal. There's one other component of the amendment that I think is important to note. Currently, I think most people think that exceeding 20 miles per hour in a school zone is automatically the maximum speed. It isn't. It is in urban areas, but otherwise basic rule applies, and it is only prima facie evidence of exceeding the basic rule. So what this amendment also does is it says, exceeding 20 miles per hour when children are present or when lights are flashing is an offense. And we feel that clarification is also very important. I also would like to say that in House Bill 2335 that you're looking at, it does include our definition of school zone, which is also extremely important. You wouldn't know how many people feel that a school zone is anywhere around a school. And that is not the case, and what this does is clarify that you do have to have signage there and clarify where the school zone is and where it ends. I thank you very much for considering this amendment, and I hope you will include it as part of House Bill 2335.
Thank you very much. We have no one else signed up to testify.
Well, Senator Courtney has an amendment. Maybe he decided not.
Uh-oh. You too. Get ready.
Senator Courtney.
Do you have any 30 minutes?
You thought that he changed your mind.
He found a relating book.
Uh-oh. It's dangerous. Mr. Chair. And members of the Public Affairs Committee. You have before you House Bill 2335, which in no way do I want to
hurt. Name on the record.
My name is Courtney, State Senator from Salem Kaiser Chapel. Democrat, first term.
You remember.
I don't think it's probably any more on the voter cancel information. I think I'll probably go right there. This bill has a relating clause that interests me. The Senate passed out Senate Bill 844 on a 26-0 vote. It came out of the Senate Judiciary Committee with a unanimous do-pass recommendation, one person excused. The bill created school safety zones, which meant that they created around schools a zone of 1,000 feet because principal, specifically the principal of North Salem High School, and Sprague came and testified with me, as well as I've checked with people like Mr. Green, others, the administrators and the school board members, even the Beaverton High School, and those that's They often have problems whereby they trespass kids in the school. Don't come in the school, you need to leave. And then the kids, they go out and hang out right there in front of the school. Gang members are come right there. Even the principal of North Salem High School had a sex offender they found and said, get out of here. And what's happened is, if they could move them back to some distance, Georgia has a statute like this. That the Georgia statute, unbeknownst to Georgia, in our opinion, is unconstitutional, because we looked at it. So we worked very hard in the Senate Judiciary Committee to create a degree of trespass whereby if an individual were to come within 1,000 feet of school district, and by the way, we already have a 1,000 feet rule in the law regarding such things as the sale of drugs and things. So we didn't just create that out of thin air. We worked very, very hard on this bill. Senator Turnell may remember this bill because it came out. Well, it went over to the House and got annihilated in a certain committee dealing with criminal law. They went off all kinds of directions. Okay. And I was even willing to amend the bill because, you know, I had these principals saying they have to live with these kinds of problems with kids. You know, they're trying to deal with the reality of everyday reality. I don't know, Mr. Chair. I don't want to hurt this bill. But there's two amendments in front of you. The first amendment, the dash 10, is the exact language in Senate Bill 844 that we passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee and that we passed off the Senate floor and would go to the Rules Committee. I have not asked. You don't have the
dash 10 amendments are not in our hands. Figure both. Here, let's get the amendments first.
Well, I don't know why they're not in hands because there are amendments to this bill. So there's the dash 10 amendments. So I'm sorry. I don't know where they are. You had a dash 11 amendment?
No.
Any others?
It's a turn amendment that happened.
Thank you for your criticism. So I have not, I want to be very upfront with you, Chair, Mr. Chair. I don't want to cut you off. I have not talked with the chair of the House Rules Committee, although he's been very nice of me to say, if this bill, if this thing is added to this bill, this is not a gotten stuff, if it's added to the bill, either one of these two amendments, and comes over to you, is it going to put in jeopardy House Bill 2335 and you refuse to concur, or will you let the bill? I mean, I haven't done that. I mean, it means to talk to representatives, because I want to be upfront about that. The one element of amendment to A11 basically is a softer version of a school safety zone than the other one, which creates a new class of misdemeanor if you're within that 1,000 feet, so that you can really come down hard on gang members or people that are harassing students or creating problems. And believe me, they are having some problems in these schools close in to their perimeter area. So that's what it, those are the two amendments. I'm sorry you don't have them. I understood that, I guess I just assumed that because I specifically asked counsel to draft these amendments, House the two, and I had both the dash 11s and the dash 10s amendments drafted, that they would have found their way to either your administrator or this committee. So I apologize if I've confused you. It's my fault, I guess. I thought that that's the process, and so you can hold me responsible. So anyway, that's the best I can do. And I don't want to read. I could read the dash 11 amendments, but why, you know, you're very busy and retired. We've had a tough day, and I won't just read it. And I don't know if you're going to make decisions today or not, Senator Wilde.
Mr. Chair, I think it's worth reading the amendments. I think I'm familiar with some of them.
Sure they are.
And
that was pretty impressive. So Armageddon doesn't get to deal with
that.
You can. You can tell it. I'm not trying to lead you down the road path at all. I don't want to hurt another good, a great. I'm just being up.
What about dash 10?
You said the 11.
Oh. That, even that was considered by people like the Hebrew School District and others to try to get some movement out of the House Committee, which they went into a constitutional law mode, if you know what I mean. No, it's not you don't, but as a lawyer, I'll tell you, I better be careful here. Once you get into that mindset on a Judiciary Committee, look out, because then you all are dressed in robes and you're a Supreme Court, and then all kinds of things happen when bills come before you. Mr. Chair, if I may say so. Maybe you understand what I'm saying. So.
May I ask a question?
You may ask a question.
There's two Judiciary Committees in the House. Which one did yours end up in the graveyard?
It ended up not in civil.
Okay.
Not in civil.
Not in civil. No, he'd arrived.
Who's he? No, in fact, I really, in fact, you know, if I may say so, you'll think I'm kissing up to them or not. I could have handled it emotionally and psychologically if he'd have looked at it and killed it. I could have handled that. I might have needed therapy, but I could have handled it. I struggle with what happened to me in front of the other committee, but I could have handled it. I wish it had gone to his committee, but it didn't. It went to, it didn't go to his committee. It went to his, the other committee.
Your good friend.
Right.
Okay, let's take a look at these movies from the other.
Okay.
Okay.
Are we going to work with this?
Mm-hmm. We're in a public hearing at the moment.
Okay.
No problem.
I won't kill it. I'm sorry.
Well, whatever. I'll do.
I don't want to hurt you. We've got time. We'll get it over to Friday morning and have time to probably edit. Want to do it?
I have a question.
Joan, would you?
Yeah. Senator Courtney. I'm looking at the deck 11.
Yes.
And it says 1,000 feet, within 1,000 feet of any real property. I guess of a school, what it amounts to. And then the school board will determine what the policy is for that land within 1,000 feet. You following me here?
I'm following you.
Okay. Does that include public sidewalks? What I'm wondering is, are we now turning over to school boards the authority to control what happens on a public sidewalk?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we are not.
You're sure?
Well, that's been thoroughly discussed as to the sidewalks in areas, and those are public. And so, therefore, you do have a situation where restrictions on those, you've got to be very, very careful about. But, you know, there's grounds and things around schools, if you know what I mean. I'm not trying to insult you. Yeah. There's grounds and things which come under the jurisdiction or can come under the jurisdiction of schools. And it's that area, although it's going to be penetrated when you get into the sidewalk situation, there is, it's no different than we have now with drugs in 1,000 feet, if you know what I mean. You know, we do have that in law now that we will really go after you. We'll really go after you if you're caught selling drugs within a certain distance of a school, wherever. So I wasn't trying to turn over anything to schools that wouldn't be properly under their jurisdiction now. But I simply was trying to empower, this one we're trying to empower school boards to make a statement about school lands within 1,000 feet so that they could empower a principal or a vice principal, whatever, to go up to kids or to warn kids, you need to move back.
I think what you're trying to do is great. This doesn't say school land, and it says local governing bodies may use school safety zone boundaries to establish exclusion zones, which I'm assuming means that they can keep people out. And I would just, Mr. Chair, like to be able to ask LCU or somebody to make sure that we're not going to be able, the school board isn't going to be able to use this to exclude picketers from being able to stand out on the sidewalk where they've always been able to be, that we're not giving them jurisdiction over 4,000 feet that may include the neighbor's private property, some of those kind of, I mean, if it were clearly to say school property, then I think you're there. And I think you're after something that's very worthwhile. I'm just a little nervous about the language.
Sure. Not a while.
Thank you. I think that's somewhat covered in any real property comprising an existing public elementary, secondary, or career school attended primarily by minors. Comprising means made up of.
It's within 100 feet of.
1,000.
1,000 feet of that stuff.
Don't you speak in.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, for the record, my name is Pat Egan, representing Beaverton Hillsborough School District, and I've been working with Senator Courtney just trying to deal with some language here that might assist. As I understand it, if you look at lines 6 and 7 of the dash A11s, the language there that would restrict what they have jurisdiction over is over pupil conduct, and I understand what you're saying about picketing activities and some of those issues. I think, at least when I was talking with legislative counsel, I wish Cindy Hunt was here, that that's what this would be restricted to, that you have a an administrator who there may be a fight just on the outside of the boundary, or if you have a park that's, say, abuts school property or something like that, you've got a situation out there that you have to deal with. As I understand it now, an administrator really doesn't have the authority to go out and deal with that situation. This would give them the ability to deal with student conduct, or excuse me, pupil conduct, occurring within any school safety zone as defined in sub 1 in the district. So I think it would be confined to that behavior.
Well, I think that piece is good, but I have still the concern about within 1,000 feet of the school property. But then down on 11 and 12, where it says local governing bodies may use school safety zone boundaries to establish exclusion zones, and it doesn't define exclusion zones, unless they're defined someplace else.
Mr. Chair, because you've got other things on the agenda, let me suggest this. If you need to pass it another day, so be it. But if you're at all interested in these amendments, I'd like to get Cindy Hunt, who's worked on this since day one, before we went into session, when she looked at the Georgia statute and told me in a two-page letter, which I was very late, why she felt that was unconstitutional, and then worked hard to deal with her concerns, to come in here and to answer these very technical questions. So, you know what I mean? I really, but it, as I say, that takes some time, can't be done today because you've got the other agenda, so I would just suggest that that's the way to handle it now. But again, if you have to pass the bill out, so be it, because obviously I can tell, listen to your members, that you're not, probably your comfort level is, you need a little bit more comfort level before you decide if you're interested in either one of these amendments.
I'm interested enough that we're going to set this over for a work session tomorrow morning, and we'll ask to invite Cindy Hunt to come in and explain these things.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to.
So,
we're going to close the public hearing. We'll not open a work session today on this. We'll go ahead for a work session tomorrow morning. Open a public hearing on HDR 4. We will have Representative Lane Shutterly and Representative Whip.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shutterly, State Representative, House District 34. And I guess I should identify myself also as basically the author of the language of the amended HCR 4 that you had before you, and chair of the committee on the House side, which considered the resolution and also the carrier of the bill on the floor. Last fall, in the case Tanner versus OHSU, the Oregon Court of Appeals held that public employers in Oregon violate Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution when they provide health insurance benefits to their married employees' spouses, but do not provide the same benefits to the same-sex partners of their gay and lesbian employees. In so holding, the court found that gay and lesbian Oregonians are entitled to certain consideration with respect to their rights under the Oregon Constitution. While the court in Tanner did not expressly address the constitutionality of Oregon's statute defining marriage, that's ORS 106.010, both legislative counsel, Mr. Chamov, and the Deputy Attorney General, David Schumann, suggested in their testimony before the House Judiciary Committee on Civil Law that the Tanner case may call into question the constitutionality of the marriage statute. HJR 4 addresses this by placing the definition of marriage in Article 15, Section 5 of the Constitution. It provides that to be valid and recognized in Oregon, a marriage may consist only of the union of one male person and one female person, and must be solemnized according to law. That's what HJR 4 does. HJR 4 does not and is not intended to otherwise repeal, implicate, or in any way limit the constitutional rights and underpinning of those rights as enunciated by the Court of Appeals in the Tanner case. HJR 4 addresses the concerns of those who would limit the legal institution of marriage in Oregon to a union between one male person and one female person. It also preserves to gay and lesbian citizens of Oregon all of the other constitutional rights and protections as found by the Tanner Court. In this way, I believe that HJR 4 achieves a reasonable middle ground on a very difficult and contentious issue that has divided Oregonians for too many years. I would be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you. any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Duke.
See what? Trying to do three things at once.
Okay, we're making a record.
Representative Shetterly, you drafted this.
Senator Dukes, I did.
Can you tell us what the purpose was?
Well, I think as I indicated in the testimony, the purpose is to define the institution of marriage, the licensed institution of marriage as constituting the union of a male person and a female person. We also did add the consideration of solemnization of the union to avoid the unintended consequence, I think, that may have resulted without that, of creating a constitutional right to common law marriage in Oregon. But we are dealing in the resolution with the definition of the institution of marriage.
As I understand it, in the Tanner decision, the Court of Appeals held that Oregon's marriage law does not permit same-sex marriages. Is that correct?
I think we would call that, I don't know that I would call that holdings, Chair, Senator Dukes. I think that was dicta. I think the comment that the court made, it was not a holding of the case because the issue was not before the court.
And in drafting this, was it your intention to have any effect on the Tanner decision?
Not apart from the definition of the institution of marriage.
Thank you.
Mr. Wiles.
Thank you, sir. I'm just trying to picture if, in fact, a religious organization within the state of Oregon made the decision that, in fact, they were going to recognize same-sex marriages. Is this to say that in spite of a religious organization taking that action, the state still, regardless of what that religious organization decided, would not recognize that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wells, that is correct. There are two aspects of marriage, at least, one being civil and one being religious for many groups. And, of course, Oregon law deals with the recognition of the civil status of marriage as constituting, as containing certain rights and obligations. We are dealing in this resolution with that civil status of marriage for the purpose of state law. Religious institution can have whatever ceremony they want and can call a relationship anything they want. But that's a matter really within the religious organization. This deals with the civil status of marriage under Oregon law.
Could I follow up? Yeah. Thank you. So in the Tanner decision, the fact that a partner would be allowed to gain benefits from being my partner, hypothetically speaking, and in fact I might find a religious organization who would consider me to be married to that partner, therefore they have the rights under the Tanner decision, and they have the religious bonding. It would seem to me that we have started to go into the civil aspects as well, because certainly the rights to have access to my benefits, say my death benefits, would certainly be considered civil in nature.
Now, Mr. Chair, Senator Wilde, I think we need to distinguish the issue of rights versus the issue of the institution of marriage as a civil status in Oregon. And HJR 4 addresses the civil status of the institution of marriage. It doesn't touch the other aspects of the Tanner case.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative Bill Witt. I was one of the initial co-authors of HJR 4, which Representative Shetterly made a couple amendments to, and I was also a member of the House Civil Judiciary Committee, which considered this measure and heard extensive testimony. What I'd like to do first is read some testimony from Mr. Greg Chamoff, Legislative Counsel, that was given to the House Civil Judiciary Committee on June 16, 1999. Specifically, I asked Mr. Chamoff, quote, is our marriage statute, which currently exists in our law, is it potentially vulnerable to the logic of Tanner, meaning the Tanner case? Mr. Chamoff's response, quote, Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes. Then I asked a follow-up question to Mr. Chamoff, quote, could you explain how it is vulnerable? And Mr. Chamoff's response is the following, quote, the state is allowed to base a law based upon a person's sexuality if there is a genuine reason for doing that, In the past, marriage laws between people of opposite sex have been upheld because of the societal value of having a committed relationship, a stable family life. If that reason was not sufficient to limit benefits to spouses in the Tanner case, I believe it's unlikely to be sufficient to limit marriage to persons of the opposite sex. What HJR 4 does is it does not overturn Tanner. What it says is that the legal logic of Tanner can't go further to compel the people of Oregon to recognize marriage between same-sex couples. It does not reverse Tanner relative to benefits. Senator Dukes asked the question about Tanner. Did Tanner affirm our marriage statute? The answer is no, and the reason the court did not specifically consider the marriage statute is because that question wasn't before the court. The plaintiffs in Tanner brought an action against Oregon Health Sciences University specifically on the issue of insurance benefits involving same-sex partners of employees who worked for OHSU. There is a footnote 3 in the Tanner case that I'd like to quote. It says, the relevant statutes define marriage in terms of a civil contract entered into by males and females who are thereby joined together as husband and wife. No party raises, and we do not address, the constitutionality of prohibiting homosexual couples from marrying. So they weren't specifically or directly considering the issue of marriage in the Tanner case. But if you look at the logic used in the Tanner case, and you look at Mr. Chamoff's interpretation of where that logically leads, should there be a case that contests our marriage statute, it leads Mr. Chamoff, and it also leads me to the conclusion that there is a probability, in my opinion, that the court would strike down our marriage statute because it bars marriage between same-sex couples. The reason HJR-4 was brought is because of the belief of the authors of that measure, and I think the belief of the majority in the House who passed this measure, that the majority of the people of Oregon wants to keep marriage, civil marriage, as a union between one man and one woman, and really don't support same-sex marriages. And, of course, as a referral to the voters, this will allow the voters to make a decision if they want to put into the Constitution protection of traditional marriage, which currently exists only in statute, and thus prevent the court from overturning our marriage statute on constitutional grounds. It is my belief that if we do nothing, and we just leave marriage in our statutes, then there is a strong likelihood that we can have the courts making the decision that Oregon must recognize same-sex marriage in the same way that we recognize marriage today between man and woman based upon constitutional grounds. So I would urge you to move this measure forward and through the Senate floor to allow the people of Oregon to have the decisive vote on this critical issue. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Wild.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so we're dealing with this as a civil action in a sense. However, if it were not to be called marriage, but someone were to bring a bill forward, let's say this goes out, this passes, and it's in the Constitution, and someone were to bring a bill forward next session that sets up a structure whereby you could have a contractual relationship between same-sex partners, but not call it marriage. Now, would that be in violation of the state constitution if it did not refer to it as a marriage, but in fact recognized it as a contract between two people, or which may otherwise, in some respects, be considered as a marriage?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wild, I don't see anything in this measure that would bar that from occurring. I'm not going to claim with any definite position.
Right,
but
it would depend on the word.
I don't see anything in this measure that would prohibit a future legislature, for example, from recognizing some other status, you know, different for marriage for same-sex couples or even for heterosexual couples, but it's not marriage.
Right.
And I might point out that initially we had an HJR 29, which we moved out of committee into the floor, which dealt both with the issue of marriage in the Constitution and also addressed the benefits issue, saying that no government entity is required to provide spousal benefits to homosexual partners of employees, as Tanner required. But frankly, we didn't have the votes in the floor for it. So we ended up taking the bill back to committee and passing this out specifically as a prohibition or a referral that would prohibit the recognition as marriage of the union of same-sex couples because it limits it to one man, one woman.
It still strikes me that we're getting at the religious aspect without getting at the religious aspect, but that's okay. We'll just watch it.
Any further questions? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Whip. We have a couple of other representatives here. Representative Janot. And let's see. Oh, we had Representative Loken, please.
For the record, my name is Julie Gianella, State Representative District 38. Mr. Chairman and colleagues, I'm here to testify in favor of HJR 4. I believe it's a fair bill. It gives the gay community their benefits, and it lets the state define marriage. And basically, I don't have any testimony to turn in, but I just wanted to speak from my heart. And I really believe that we need to define marriage for the children. I believe the environment of the children is at stake. I see that we're concerned about the salmon and the water and the air, but there's another environment there. There's the environment and the new environment that we're raising our children in. And it's hard for parents in this day and age to set a boundary and to set an environment for them. I believe that we're raising a confused generation of children that are begging for boundaries and they're begging for some kind of parameter to be set to know what's what, to know what the rules are, to know what's right. And I believe we have a duty to the children of this state to speak up and do something and say it, have a statement. I really urge the passage of HJR4 to the Senate floor, and I speak from my heart on behalf of the next generation that if we sit back and just let things go any old way they want to, and we don't do what's right for our children, that we're going to reap the benefits. I really urge you, for the sake of the children of the state of Oregon, to define marriage. And I thank you. I think it's a fair bill. I think it gives the gay community their benefits, and it also gives parents the opportunity to define marriage for families and for children. I thank you.
Any questions?
Sure, I have one.
Mm-hmm. Senator Duke.
But if marriage between a man and a woman is all the only kind of marriage that's legal in Oregon now, what do we gain from this?
I don't think, before the Tanner case, I don't think there was any need to define marriage. But now I believe that we need to step in and do something before marriage gets defined as being between anyone. It's always been between a man and a woman, but I don't think we can take the chance. And if we sit back and just let things happen all the time, pretty soon we're trying to defend something when we should have done something in the first place and just made a statement.
We've already had testimony that indicated that the Tanner decision did not make any comment on or did not change or allude to there's anything legal in Oregon other than marriage between a man and a woman, but it didn't impact that.
Well, we believe that we need to send this to the voters, and we believe we need to get it set in stone so that we know what we're doing, so that we know, so the children in the future will know, and so that we know, so that we're not haggling over this or trying to do something with it different with it later. We need to get it established and set. I know it's always been that way, but we can't count on it as always being that way. A lot of things have changed in this state, and Oregon is a leader in a lot of directions. And, you know, I just really feel like we need to step in there and guard the children. Somebody has to guard the children. And I believe it's a very important stage and a very important step. I think it's an important deal.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Invite Tom Vetri. David
Sedanke. Very keen.
Senator Starr, thank you for inviting me and allowing me to testify. I am Dominic Vetri, and for identification purposes, I am a professor of law at the University of Oregon. I am speaking today in my individual capacity. Thank you. I recommend against the adoption of HJR 4. This latest proposal, unlike its predecessor, HJR 29, has at least removed the provisions which would have amended Oregon's Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause in an attempt to overturn the Tanner Court of Appeals case and the employment benefits and equal protection implications of that decision. We appreciate the legislative wisdom in eliminating those consequences in this proposal. Nonetheless, I urge you to drop the entire matter and to reject placing a constitutional definition of marriage on the ballot. I do so for three reasons. One, it is bad public policy. Two, it will do great harm once again to Oregon's social fabric. And three, it will leave another blot on Oregon's constitutional history, a history already regrettably stained with mistreatment of minority peoples. HJR 4 is bad public policy. First, the proposal is unnecessary. Oregon law already defines marriage as the union of a man and a woman. Same-sex marriages are not recognized in Oregon. There are no immediate threats to Oregon's marriage law and little likelihood that the courts will in the near future overturn the marriage law. Moreover, the resolution will do nothing to protect or strengthen opposite-sex marriages. Gay and lesbian people have formed relationships and commitments and developed families over the years throughout Oregon. These gay and lesbian families exist now and will continue to exist even if HJR 4 were adopted by the public. If the institution of heterosexual marriage is seen in any way as threatened, it is certainly not because of gay and lesbian relationships. More fundamentally, the essence of HJR 4 is discrimination. At one point in American history, African-American men and women were prohibited from marrying. The definition of marriage did not include slaves. They could form relationships, but the law would not honor them. We would consider it disgraceful today to have a white-only state constitutional definition of marriage. Still later, many state laws prohibited interracial marriage. Marriage was defined as same race only, on the ground that preservation of racial integrity was a valid public purpose. Such laws actually remained on the books until as late as 1967, when the U.S. Supreme Court held such laws violative of the Federal Equal Protection Clause in Loving v. Virginia. We would consider it disgraceful today to have amended the U.S. Constitution to define marriage as same race only as a means to get around the Loving decision, or to set a boundary, if you will, as to what the definition of marriage is. Indeed, we would consider those who merely propose such state-by-state ballot measures to amend the Constitution to have acted out of prejudice. Furthermore, when the U.S. Supreme Court first held that women as a class were entitled to protection under the Equal Protection Clause, we now respect the wisdom of our system to correct errors of tradition. We would consider it disgraceful today to have amended the U.S. Constitution or even attempted to do so to make an exception to exclude women. What lesson can we draw from the history? Traditions often seem sensible at the time, and most often are, but some traditions embody irrational prejudice, and we must carefully examine the real reasons and motives for excluding certain classes of people from full participation in our cultural institutions. I respectfully submit that the rush to place HJR 4 on the ballot is nothing more than acceding to the emotions of the moment about the nature of marriage, not unlike what some of our forebears did with regard to interracial marriage. Let us be courageous at this moment in history and say no to emotional reactions and allow reason and the rule of law to work its will. HJR 4 also will do great harm. Placing the marriage provision on the ballot will mean putting the civil rights of Oregon's gay and lesbian citizens up for debate and a vote once again. Oregon has had enough of such measures. Such measures do substantial harm not only to gay and lesbian folk, but to the understanding of all Oregonians about equal respect and concern for everyone. We live in a time of terrible violence against people solely because of their differences. The terrible crimes in the Midwest over the 4th of July weekend are only the latest example. With respect, I suggest that putting an anti-gay provision on the ballot is not a helpful means of teaching tolerance and respect for minorities. Voting for HJR 4 will inevitably be seen by biased people as continued justification for prejudice against gay men and lesbians, not just on the basis of marriage, but in all the other ways discrimination manifests its ugliness, from employment discrimination to brutal crime. Thirdly, HJR 4 would be a stain on Oregon's constitutional history. We have had the sad experience of reckoning with how our Oregon forebears dealt with the civil liberties of African Americans and Asian Americans. We have even held public meetings to express our regret for such maltreatment. It seems so easy to see the error of those ways in today's world. Yet we are often blinded in the heat of current passions to our mistreatment and the lack of fairness accorded other minority communities. HJR 4 is understood by many people as an anti-gay measure, plain and simple. Voting to limit the civil liberties of a minority group is at odds, I would submit, with the ideals and values of our state and nation. It is one thing for narrow-minded groups to put the civil rights of a minority up for a vote, but quite another matter when a legislative body of Oregon does so. Let us not have to look back some years down the road and regret the way we acted on HJR 4. In conclusion, I urge you to reject HJR 4. You have each met many good and decent men and gay men and lesbians in recent years in all walks of life. Like all citizens, we contribute productively in many ways to a better life for all of us. Gay people have put our faith in the role of reason, the rule of law, and our political institutions. We have placed our faith, too, in the courageousness and integrity of you, our legislators, of all Oregonians, as guardians and representatives of all the people, including gay men and lesbians, Oregonians. We ask that you let reason and law be your guide today. Thank you.
I have a question. If Central Light passed this law, do you know anything terrible that's happened over there?
The situation in Hawaii is in a very mixed setting right now. The Hawaii Supreme Court has never finalized a decision allowing same-sex couples to marry. It made a preliminary decision and sent the matter back to the lower court, and in the intervening time, the state legislature tried to pass a law also and put on the ballot a measure which would limit the definition of marriage to opposite sex couples.
And it passed it.
And it passed Hawaii, and that is now in litigation in the courts.
Well, I thought they made a constitutional amendment.
Pardon?
Wouldn't it be overturned by the court?
It's now being debated on a number of different grounds before the Hawaii Supreme Court.
Mr. Sedanke, did you want to add to that?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, I will get to that. Mr. Senator Shannon, thank you. For the record, David Sedanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. And since this is my first opportunity to testify before your committee this session, Mr. Chair, I want to point out, for those of you that don't know, I am not an attorney. I will try to speak to you in English today. But there are some complicated legal principles at issue with HJR 4. And I want to try to discuss some of those, but if I lose you, please holler, and I'll try to go back over it. Senator Dukes asked Representative Shetterly earlier in her questions whether or not the Court of Appeals had made a holding in the Tanner decision that Oregon law currently prohibits same-sex marriages. And the court did make that finding. It had to make that finding before it ever got to the constitutional issues or even the statutory issues in that case. because that was the heart of the case. If gay and lesbian couples were permitted to marry under Oregon law, they could have easily brought themselves within the class that would have entitled them to the insurance benefits at issue in the Tanner case. And the court did make the specific finding that is because, and I'm quoting now, that is because under Oregon law, homosexual couples may not marry. So we have a clear decision from an Oregon appellate court, which was not appealed, that current Oregon law does prohibit same-sex marriage. Now, that is also, as Representative Shetterly pointed out, where the court dropped this little footnote saying that they were not going to reach the issue of whether or not the marriage statute was constitutional. I understand that the proponents of this bill see that footnote as being somewhat ominous, but that is a very typical thing for the Oregon Court of Appeals or the Oregon Supreme Court to do in the course of a decision. Where they are dealing with constitutional issues, where they are dealing with interpretations of the statute, to say what they're not deciding as well as what they are deciding. I do not see that as ominous at all for the marriage statute and its constitutionality under the Oregon Bill of Rights. Immediately after the court dropped that footnote in the Tanner decision, they went on to look at the statute, let me back up a second here. The first question in the Tanner case was whether the denial of insurance benefits to gay and lesbian couples violated Oregon discrimination law. And the court held that discrimination based on sexual orientation was prohibited under Oregon anti-discrimination law, but that the denial of insurance benefits was not prohibited because there was a separate statute, ORS 659.028, which said that the anti-discrimination provisions of the Oregon anti-discrimination law, the rights statutes, don't apply to benefit plans unless those benefit plans were adopted in order to, as a subterfuge, to carry out discrimination. Now, the court held immediately after dropping this footnote about the marriage statute, they held that this other statute made an exception for that allowed employers to deny insurance benefits in Oregon. They didn't say that that statute was unconstitutional. I don't know why the court, if asked, would say that the marriage statute was unconstitutional. The court then went on to look at the constitutional issue, whether or not Article 1, Section 20, the Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause of the Oregon Constitution, required Oregon Health Sciences University to grant domestic partnership benefits. And Article 1, Section 20, which is really the target of this resolution before you today, says no law shall be passed granting to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which upon the same terms shall not equally belong to all citizens. In plain English, that section of our Oregon Bill of Rights says that no group of citizens is entitled to special rights. There shall not be special rights for any class of Oregon citizens. It's there in our Constitution. It's been there since 1857. And it was on the basis of that provision that the court said employees who do equal work are entitled to equal pay and equal benefits, and that on the basis of this provision, OHSU is required to grant insurance benefits. Now, it's acknowledged, I think, by everyone who's testified today that this resolution before you will not affect that portion of the Tanner decision. It will not, I don't think, affect in any way the Tanner decision. What it does do is put language into the Constitution that requires discrimination against the class of citizens for all time, or at least until such time as the voters might choose to repeal this provision. It may also do other things, and I am just going to assume for the sake of argument that a majority of this committee supports HJR 4 in its current form. But I want to urge you to be very, very cautious and to think carefully about what the collateral damage from this measure might be. The first phrase of the language that would be added, to be valid and recognized in this state, a marriage may consist only of the union of one male person and one female person. To be valid and recognized in this state. Now, I assume the purpose for inserting that language is to prevent the state of Oregon from recognizing same-sex marriages if some other state ever adopts that and permits it. Mm-hmm. No state currently does. We don't think it's necessary to put it in the Constitution. But the other effect of this provision may be to require the state of Oregon to recognize any marriage from another state that is between a male person and a female person for all time. Now, why is that important? That is important because some states do not have the same age limits that Oregon has for entering into a marriage contract. Under Oregon law, marriage can only be entered into by a male person age 17 and a female person age 17. But in some other states, that is not the law. In the state of Georgia, for example, generally the limitation is age 16. However, if the female is pregnant, or if the female and male are parents of a child born out of wedlock, the age limits do not apply at all. And I'm aware of a case that went into juvenile court in Lane County, down in Eugene, that involved a girl who was 13 years old, who had essentially been seduced by a man who was 40 years old, and he had...
You know, this is all probably in some way germane, but it's your testimony is going longer than I desired.
Well,
I'd like for you to shorten up your testimony. We've got members that have other obligations.
Appreciate that. Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. I'll try to wrap this up very quickly. The point is that this man, who was 40, committed what in Oregon would constitute first-degree sexual abuse, a felony crime. But because he had taken this girl to Georgia and married her legally under Georgia law and brought her back to the state of Oregon after that, the district attorney in Lane County decided he could not prosecute under current law because Oregon law currently recognizes such marriages.
Just a second. All states do under the full faith and credit law. That's why it's a concern last session when Hawaii was about to legalize same-sex marriages, and this is a preemptive strike, and I have a hard time all this discrimination. We've been a state since, 1859? And all of a sudden you're going to find that this discrimination in every state has marriage between a man and a woman?
Mr. Chair and Senator Shannon, it is one thing to have a provision in statute. The point I'm trying to get across is that it is something entirely different when you lock that into the Constitution. And as the previous witness testified, we have had numerous provisions in our Oregon Constitution in the past which require discrimination. We believe that HR 4 is unnecessary, certainly unnecessary at this time, and we strongly urge you to oppose it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Jerry Keene. I'm here on behalf of Log Cabin Republicans of Oregon, and I'm on the National Board of Log Cabin. And although I am a lawyer and don't just play one at legislative hearings, I'm not here to make the legal case for or against the change. In fact, I don't think the strongest arguments, either for or against this resolution, have much to do with law. I don't think this changes any current law, and actually, given the compromise that was drawn, I don't know that it prevents much effective change either. And so really the primary point here is more of a symbolic one. And in that vein, if I might, offer a little bit of a perspective. First of all, I have to get something off my chest. I admit it. I have committed monogamy. I understand that that's wrong, and that for 11 years my partner Rob and I have been engaged in relentless assault on the institution of marriage. We have attended scurrilously every family birthday party and Christmas celebration as members of the family, Rob and I. We've scandalously aided family members whenever they've asked us for help, and certainly my partner's brother has no qualms calling me his brother-in-law when he's asking for money. We've brazenly pooled our resources to build a home and to build a life together that's based on mutual trust and mutual commitment. We are about as married as we can be, and whether you let us call it marriage or not isn't going to affect that much. But you see, this isn't a fight about whether you're for or against family values. What it comes down to is this is a bid once more to have a good old knock-down, drag-out fight about who gets to have them. But who gets to have family values, not whether we're for them or against them or whether we're going to threaten them or not threaten them. And I would pose this question to you, and I don't trust that everybody shares this perspective, but to me there's this puzzling trend. When we suggest that we need discrimination laws to protect our ability to work and make a living and pay taxes, people object to that. When we suggest maybe that we're good enough to openly serve and fight in the military and put our lives on the line for our country, people go crazy over that. And when we suggest modestly that maybe we would like to share and cherish too the institution of marriage and to honor it, that drives some people up the wall. And I have to wonder, are they more afraid that we are not going to be healthy and contributing members of society, or maybe they're more scared that we will? This fight that this begs the state to have one more time really just singles us out. One more time. Are you for them or against them? It isn't about the legalism of marriage any more than really Measure 9 was or Measure 13 was. It's are you for them or against them? Take a side. Let's fight about it one more time. And I'm here as a member of the state that's lived through it to suggest to you that no matter how you feel about the merits of this issue, that the potential benefit you might get from putting this on the ballot one more time is far, far less than the negative effects that we're all going to feel on both sides of the issue from having to fight it out one more time. It will be bad for the state, bad externally for its image, bad internally for us in the energy and the money that it will divert from other things that really are problems. It'll be bad, frankly, for our party, because it will falsely feed the image of us as judgmental extremists when it's just not so. And I would remind the members of the committee who weren't there or don't remember, the Dorchester Republican Conference had this issue on its agenda, and it was debated and voted on. I debated Representative Mannix. And in that crowd, it was voted down by 3-1. And tellingly, a big chunk of people just abstained and said, we don't want to vote on this at all. We don't even want to talk about it again. And I suggest to you that one segment of the Republican Party, translate that over to the rest of the state. And I think you can get a solid majority of the people who just don't agree this is worth fighting about again. And even if the state isn't tired of fighting about it, frankly, Rob and I are tired of being on the ballot so you can fight about us. We're tired of being fought about. Please quit taking sides about us. We would hope that by now you're getting as tired of it as we are. Thank you.
actually something real quick. I know I won't leave. But the Democrat Party in the 70s took a real less liberal view. I mean, if you weren't for the ERA and abortion and funding of, you couldn't get money from the Democrat Party. And about 1978, the Democrats were in control. 36 counties, they were the majority party in all 36. And Republicans started taking a stand on what you're calling the family values, and some people say, oh, you're bad for the party and all that. And we now are the majority party in 24 counties, and the family values position hasn't hurt us. Our party is growing, and they're losing members, and they only have 12 counties now. And when you say people go crazy, you haven't seen a gay pride parade. You've never seen crazy people.
Senator Shannon from Maryland, you've known me for 15 years. Okay. You know my life and my style. You were there when I ran for the legislature. All four times you supported me. I was there trying to run in the year of Measure 9 against an uphill tide of Democrat and independent voters who were energized, the same kind of swing voters who make the difference in statewide elections, which if you haven't noticed, it's been quite a while since we've won one. Yes, it's been good in rural counties and the way things are apportioned. It's worked out in legislative leadership. That's certainly threatened. That's certainly threatened when you're leading, when you're, if you want to just talk cars and politics, it's threatened when your suburban county is full of swing independent voters who are turned off by this, even if they think other parts of your agenda are good. We can debate that all day, but the issue is whether it's going to be good for us as a party to make this our rallying cry instead of the other kinds of issues that are out there.
Well, there's 800 bills this session, and this is only one.
But I can measure the number of points type this one gets in the headline and the amount of press it gets compared to all the other issues we'll vote on.
I suppose if you would stay out of the court, we'd stay out of these bills.
Oh, we didn't pick this fight. We didn't pick this fight. This has never been our issue. This has been somebody else's agenda, and we're just forced to come to it. We've been a lot more interested in trying to get justice in terms of not getting fired and not getting evicted.
Who did, Tanner? From a petrol official? Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close public hearing open the work session on HDR 4.
Which one did you
do? She's gone. She is tested it out. Are you in a work session?
I'm in a work session.
Okay, I move HDR 4 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Shannon has moved HDR 4 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Clerk call roll.
Senator Shannon.
Aye.
Senator Charles. Aye. Senator Wilde.
No.
Yourself.
Aye. Okay. I received the necessary majority HDR 4 moved to the floor to do pass recommendations. Senator will carry.
I see you have new
carriers. Open the work session on House Bill 2670. We've got before us the dash
B8.
The B8 dash B8 amendment. We're in work sessions. We need the dash B8 amendments moved.
Mr. Chairman, the dash B8 amendments to House Bill 2670.
Senator Tarnow has moved the dash B8 amendments to House Bill 2670. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
B8. Yeah. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2670 as amended to the floor due pass recommendation.
Senator Tarnow has moved House Bill 2670 to the floor for due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Tarnow.
Aye.
Senator Wilde.
Aye.
Yourself.
Aye. I receive the necessary majority. House Bill 2670 as amended to move the floor for due pass recommendation. Chair will carry.
Well, Senator Wilde volunteered to chair.
Oh, I didn't hear me. I didn't hear me. We're going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 1335. Senator George.
Yeah. How are the hazelnuts?
Thank you, Chairman Starr. For the record, State Senator Gary George, District 2. Part of District 2 includes Yamhill County, and Yamhill County was one of the first counties to adopt urban reserve. And it's a way back then. I'll tell you what I'm doing here, folks, if you can bear with me, and we may want to go to another bill, is we have a negotiation going on outside about this.
This is our last bill.
This is it, then I'll stop. I'll tell you the story. Okay. Back in the summer of 43.
There was a hazelnut grower.
Okay, basically what happened is when the urban reserve was prepared by the city of Newburgh, many of us complained because what they did is done is they went out and they gathered up all what appeared to be all of the Class 1 soil. Some of you had to listen to me tell the story. And I did at the time. I said, are you sure you really want to do this? Well, anyway, as you can see from the way the bill is structured, is that if, in fact, the negotiations between the city and the county break down, it seems to have consequences to the county. And what I'm going to do at this point, if you don't mind, I'm going to wait for them to get in here and have them more aptly explain where they are. Basically, the negotiation broke down. The county believes that if the urban reserve agreement should come to an end, that they would be stuck with the 2-mile radius moratorium on a building in that area. Now, to give you an example of what would happen there, is if you went out 2 miles from the city of Newburgh's urban growth boundary or urban reserve, depending on which line they would decide to draw, you're going to find yourself on the poorest soil that's in the area of Newburgh. You guys would be very familiar with that. You'd be looking at the Shenandoah Mountain, mostly stony land area. It would be a place that would be reasonable to think that you might actually be able to get some development that might not affect the actual quality soil that still remains around the Newburgh area. So that would be a very good thing to have happen compared to the city just continuing to expand out until it covered it all up. Also, as part of that, the county could, in fact, look to the north slopes behind the Dundee Hill, which, again, is marginal soil, and the county could look at actually having some development occur there. But the way they're reading this, and that's why the negotiation is going on outside, that they believe that with the breakdown in agreement between the county and the city, that actually the moratorium on any development within 2 miles would come to play. Are they here yet? Let me tell you a little story about the whole process. Years ago, when this was first prepared, all right, we have Commissioner Johnstone, and we have Commissioner Bunn, and Ken Freddy, who's the head planner. Come on, sit down. I've been telling this story about farmland. I told you we're in negotiations about this. I'll let you
finish. Oh, boy. Senator Starr, my name is Ken Friday. I'm the senior planner with the Yamhill County Planning Department. Senate Bill 1335, the operative language is found in subsection 4 of section 1. And as when LCDC established the urban reserve rule, they established a penalty that would fall on the county if the county does not adopt the urban reserve area and subsequently the urban reserve area agreement. The penalty is a moratorium on partitions and subdivisions within 2 miles of the city's urban growth boundary. And the specific administrative rule provision is found in OAR 660-21-080-4. The problem when this was established is that there is no corresponding penalty on the city. Our office originally expressed concern about this when the LCDC was holding hearings on this, but were assured that this would not be a problem. The rule allows for LCDC to enforce on a city if they opt out, but there's no corresponding automatic penalty on that city. The rule was written to encourage the county to cooperate in developing and completing the urban reserve area requirements, and to date we have completed those requirements, and on February 11th of this year we received a letter from DLCD confirming that we had completed those requirements. Now the city, specifically the city of Newburgh, wants to renegotiate not the urban reserve area,
but they want to renegotiate the urban growth boundary agreement, and they are threatening to end the urban reserve area agreement to provide, quote, leverage, as one city councilor stated, in order to get a better agreement with the county. And this forces the county, of course, into an awkward situation. If we don't give in to the demands, and it's to this point we're pretty far apart and but are still bargaining with the city, it will mean that there will be a moratorium on partitions and subdivisions in exception areas within 2 miles of the Newbridge urban growth boundary. This arbitrarily freezes thousands of acres and at least 150 property owners by our count hold property within that area in our county. The area also goes into both Washington and Marion counties, which I'd like to note have no direct voice in this dispute. If the county does give in to their demands, there's nothing to stop the city from, again, using this, quote, leverage on another issue. We believe that the rule has fulfilled the purpose it was designed for. We have adopted an urban reserve area and an urban reserve area agreement. We believe it is not appropriate for the city to be able to prohibit partitions or subdivisions of property owned by county residents, especially when those county residents don't have the corresponding right to vote for city council members. And lastly, I'd like to point out that the wording of the bill does not allow the county to opt out of its responsibility of the urban reserve area or urban reserve area agreement. It only prohibits the city from forcing this moratorium into the county. The penalty would still fall if the county were to decide to eliminate the program. Are there any questions? And I have provided a map that shows the area that would be affected by this.
Yeah, you're giving us a lot of information. I fail to see how it resolves the issue of the bill that's before us. What are you telling us regarding the bill specifically?
Subsection 4 of the bill is the operative provision that prevents the penalty that's established in the administrative rule that would prevent subdivisions and partitions. It would prevent that from being effective if the city opts out of the urban reserve area agreement after the city and county have adopted such an agreement. So it would prevent a penalty from falling on the county should the city decide on their own to opt out of such an agreement.
So that's good or bad?
That's good for the county, and at least we would not be under a penalty when another jurisdiction decides they want to renegotiate something with the county.
I
should note it would put us on equal footing. There would be no corresponding penalty on the city, and then there would be no corresponding penalty on the county. It would put us on equal footing so that we could reach an agreement together.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Does that mean that if the city and county agreed on an urban reserve area, we designed it, and then later the city says, no, we want to go this way, that's not the area we want for an urban reserve, but the county would still be able to develop it as an urban reserve?
No, actually there is a prohibition on zone changes to allow a higher intensity of uses. The county could allow partitions and subdivisions. Our agreements right now that we would like to maintain requires us to ask the city's input on that and also to get a redevelopment plan. So there is some checks and balances with our existing agreement. What we want to do is make sure that the city cannot opt out and force a penalty upon the county residents particularly.
Yes, what I'm wondering is, if the county did continue to allow things, would there be no penalty?
There would be opportunity for LUBA appeals just like as there is today. The county would have to abide by its share of the agreement, or we would probably be under enforcement order with LCDC. But there is no, there would be no penalty if the city decided to opt out of the agreement.
What I'm trying to get at is, I have a concern that we keep
we see development happy, and we're out there developing all kinds of areas, and urban reserve is something we don't worry about in my part of the state. We're, you know, serious urban growth boundaries within the city limits, so I don't get into things like urban reserves. But that if you were to agree this is an urban reserve, and then somebody changes their mind, and then we have the urban reserve over here now, but we're still doing development over here. And Senator George and I have this conversation every once in a while that we would still like to be able to farm some of this land. And it seems to me we're creeping out. And development will do that, and land use planning encourages that. And we want to keep it at least close to the city. But I want to make sure we don't end up here by taking away the penalties that would allow one side or the other to go ahead and do stuff, even though they shouldn't be doing it because there's no penalties for it.
Well, the areas that are designated as urban reserves have several layers of protection on them. First of all, we can't upzone them. We can't rezone them to a higher intensity of use. And we also have a requirement to have the city's input whenever there's any sort of development that goes on in those areas. That is what the county would like to maintain. The county has adopted those areas. We'd like to maintain those areas. If the city decides they want to adopt other urban reserve areas, that would be something that we would cooperatively do. This penalty is one that's established to penalize the county if the county was unwilling to adopt or develop an urban reserve area or urban reserve area agreement. The county has done that, and the county has, with the cooperation in this case of the city of Newburgh, we have done that. We have completed that. However, the city sees that there's an opportunity to provide leverage for an agreement that doesn't directly fall into the urban reserve area, the urban growth boundary agreement. They'd like to get a better agreement. They'd also like to get a better agreement regarding what they call the area of influence, an area outside of that. And so they have selected to use this as leverage, as one of their city council members stated in a public hearing, that they would like to use this leverage to force the county to come to the bargaining table and give away some of the rights of the citizens within those areas. The county board of commissioners is unwilling to do that. Now, if the city eliminates their urban reserve area agreement, the county has a penalty. The city has no corresponding penalty. So we are at a disadvantage when we are negotiating with them. That's what we are trying to eliminate. We believe we play the game fairly, and that we have adopted an urban reserve area. We are protecting that urban reserve area. We are abiding by the urban reserve area agreement. We don't believe that it's the right of the city to put this penalty on county residents when we are abiding by the law.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Starr, members of the committee. My name is Robert Johnstone. I'm chairman of the Amhill County Board of Commissioners. I want to simply reiterate some of the things that Ken said. We believe that this piece of legislation is necessary to prevent the county from being penalized for having negotiated in good faith with the city. To be honest with you, several sessions ago when the legislation was created that allowed the creation of urban reserve areas, there were two processes that had to happen. First of all, the city's that wanted to be a part to identify urban reserve areas outside their city limits had to apply to the state at that time. Newburgh was one of those cities. There were just a limited number of cities that did that. Newburgh was one of them. The two parts that had to be satisfied were, one, the city and the county had to agree on the geographic outline of those urban reserve areas. So Yamhill County and the city of Newburgh did do that. We held a series of public hearings. We identified those areas. The second part was to draft an urban reserve area management agreement that stipulated how the development patterns would occur within the urban reserve areas. City of Newburgh and Yamhill County met together and through our planning departments and attorneys came up with an agreement that met state requirements. Prior to that, the DLCD enacted an administrative rule that created this penalty of a moratorium on building subdivisions outside of the city as really a lever to force the counties to the table, so to speak, so that they couldn't just drag the process out for a long time and not come to any
agreement on anything. We bargained in good faith with the county or with the city. We got the urban areas identified. We got an agreement that's been acknowledged by the state now. There's no need for the penalty to apply. The city of Newburgh has subsequently given us notice saying they want to opt out of their urban area management agreement they have with the county. The result being that, in our opinion, triggers the administrative rule that creates this moratorium. They unilaterally, by giving us notice that they want to opt out of this agreement that we bargained in good faith, now all of a sudden limits the rights of property owners in the unincorporated area of Yamhill County that are not a part of the urban growth boundary, they're not a part of the urban reserve area. Those other areas, though it may affect lands within those areas, but the greatest impact is in the unincorporated areas outside the UGB and the urban reserve area, to where they cannot divide their land. Now, when otherwise, if they're eligible, they could have done so, and this is because of the unilateral action taken by the Newburgh City Council. We feel like our hands are tied. The rights of the property owners, they have no recourse to the city of Newburgh. Their hands are tied. And one of the things that it has done is accelerated the application for land subdivisions in the unincorporated area of the county in a matter that I don't think was intended by DLCD. So it really has had the negative effect in some folks' minds of accelerating development in the urban area, in the unincorporated areas, simply because these people that own these properties want to preserve their right before this agreement ends. And so we think the fix is in this bill that says if a city sends notice that they want to discontinue this agreement, the penalty doesn't fall on the county. And that's all this bill does.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tom Bunn. I'm the Yamhill County Commissioner, and I am here to represent not only myself, but also Commissioner Ted Lopuszynski, who would like me to relay that he is very much in support of this bill. And I'm here to represent the 150 property owners that are affected negatively by the LCDC's administrative rule. I, of course, also represent the people that live within the city of Newburgh, and we try to balance both those interests, which is not what the members of the city council have to do. All they have to do is look at their interests. We on the board look at the interests of both groups of people. And I think, as my colleague has mentioned, it's very unfair that those property owners are penalized because of a decision of people that they're not represented by. And I couldn't really add anything more than Commissioner Johnstone and our senior planner have already indicated. They've given you the gist of it, and I'm very supportive of the Senate bill.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Any questions? No questions. We're going to have Philip Bell and Bob Rindy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. We've only had a couple hours to look at this change to the statute and to try and understand its implications and what it might do ultimately to our program. One of the things that we are at this point willing and ready to testify without, and I want to emphasize part of the problem with not having very much time to look at something like this is not enough time to get legal counsel's opinion on the effect of this. But our opinion at this point is that this is unnecessary and that there are remedies in place right now for the problems that the county just described to you. The first of all, the rule itself establishes an interim measure in order to encourage cities and counties to come together and agree on management of an urban reserve area. And that did happen, and the county and the city did agree. The rule is very clear in its wording that until such time as they agree and formally adopt agreement, certain interim measures are in effect. But the rule does not in any way imply or state that if at some point in the future, any point in the future, one of the requirements for urban reserve planning goes away, such as the agreement, that those interim measures are reinstated. The whole theory of this bill is that for some reason the 2-mile limit on subdivisions is going to be reinstated if the city or the county ever, from now on, pull out of that urban reserve agreement. And we simply don't think that that's a logical reading of the rule. The language in the rule, there are 3 or 4 places where this whole thing comes up, all speak to an interim measure that goes away upon such time as the city and the county agree on an urban reserve area, and the city and county have agreed. It's therefore our opinion that if the city were to unilaterally rescind their agreement with the county, that would be a land use action on the part of the city. It would be appealable to LUBA. LUBA would, in our opinion, would remand that action, and that would result in the agreement being reinstated. That's a remedy to the problem that was described. It's a remedy that's available now under our rules and under statute, and therefore there is no reason to adopt this measure. I don't know at this point of prior case law that might support this. I would be happy if you would delay action on this today to try and follow as quickly as I can with a formal legal opinion that we would try to obtain from our legal counsel to this effect. That's the best we can offer you now at this point.
Appreciate that very much.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Philip Fell from the League of Oregon Cities. We are a statewide organization representing 238 of Oregon City, including the potentially rogue city of Newburgh. I must tell you that I know nothing of the details of the disagreement in the Newburgh Yamhill County area. But I can say this. I agree with Mr. Rindy that this is currently appealable under current law. And think passing the bill would remove that incentive to continue negotiations. You should know that the city has extended the validity of their agreement with the county for 90 days with the hope that they can sit down and negotiate. I think that it should have been, it was the intention, I think, of those people who created Senate Bill 100, that these sort of decisions should be made locally. And I would encourage you to let that process happen, or let them sit down and negotiate more. I think any party to the kind of agreement that exists between the city and county ought to have the right to discuss renegotiating that agreement. So I would encourage you to vote no on this bill. If they cannot reach agreement in Yamhill County, then there is a process in law now to pursue. And if they can reach the agreement, I think that's the best way.
Mr. Chair. Senator
Duke. I only differ with you on one piece. And they should sit down and work it out together with both players being equal players.
Right.
And that's my only concern here. I'm not going to tell you I fully understand this. I hope I'll get there before we do something with the bill. But when I get a full board of county commissioners saying this is what's going on, I pay attention.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I don't blame you. That makes sense. I'd be glad to bring a city person down if you would like to hear their side of the story.
Oh, I'm just anxious that whatever we do, we make sure that as they go through this process that they're both sides are fully equal players, and one doesn't have the upper hand.
You have, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If I could answer possibly that question, Senator Dukes, there is a provision in our rule whereby if a county makes findings that the city failed to negotiate in good faith toward meeting these requirements, that including the requirements of this agreement, an LCDC is authorized to unilaterally adopt or extend that urban reserve area. And I believe that the effect of that language would be that an additional remedy, if indeed the county felt that what was happening here is not bargaining in good faith, that LCDC, in addition to LUBA, would have their authority to rescind the 2-mile limit. If, again, we don't agree that the 2-mile limit would be reinstated, but if there was some concern that it would be, I think the commission also. So there are actually 2 remedies here to make sure that this is good faith negotiation. And I wholeheartedly agree with you. It ought to be, it was intended that it would be a balanced two-sided negotiation, and we would not want to see either side gain the upper hand.
I thank you very much. We've got one other witness, and I'd like to invite Mr. Bunn to come back up. We have Monty Schlud.
Chairman, members of the city, thank you for giving this opportunity to appear at this time. I'm here as a proponent of the bill, of Senate Bill 1335. And I have to tell you that I am a citizen who resides in the area affected by this. And I sit here and I listen to this talk by all of these different people representing various agencies of government, and they cannot even agree as to whether or not there is a legal remedy for the county to not have a draconian moratorium placed over them. As a citizen of this area, I feel that it's a failure on the part of government to allow this to go on. I think that the playing field at the present time is very much tilted towards the city because they have had the opportunity to use this leverage language, etc. So already the table is tilted. And I think that only through legislative action is it going to be leveled out again. At present, because of the failure of Yamhill County and the City of Newburgh to reach an agreement over the maintenance of an urban reserve area, this heavy sword hangs over the heads of some 147 property owners in this area. This sword is a moratorium over the partition and subdivision of property within 2 miles of Newburgh's urban growth boundary. These properties actually lie outside the present Newburgh urban reserve area. And this, of course, as you heard, is dictated by LCDC regulation. Now, this is, to me, this is, as just a citizen sitting here, this is a very arbitrary and capricious act, as the properties in question lie on the edge of Newburgh's urban growth boundary and have nothing to do with the siting of an urban reserve area. That's already been taken care of, as has been stated. Now, if this moratorium comes into being, significant property rights will be taken from the owners of the properties of these properties without due process of law or without just due and just compensation. How would you like to own property and suddenly receive in the mail a statement that unless you make move to partition or subdivide your property within 90 days, you won't ever be able to do so again unless the two government entities get together and square it away. I think this is very unfair. Many of the persons that own the affected properties are elderly or approaching retirement age, and they plan to partition their properties to help provide for their retirement. And now they'll not be able to do so if this moratorium comes into effect. Now, years ago, when this land use planning first really came into effect around that area, I recall it well as I've lived in the same place for some 30 years, the people in the area went for it and voted for a type of dividing of the properties under 2.5 acres. And a lot of them, though, continued to hold on to their small holdings, farms, 10, 20 acres, etc. But now as they are getting older, they're looking forward to subdividing the property down and providing some income for their retirement. And if this moratorium comes into effect, it certainly will not be able to be done. I think the Senate Bill 1335 would put an end to these acts, these arbitrary and capricious actions of removing significant property rights from the property owners in the area. And it would come back to, it would put us back to, as I stated before, a level playing field where the parties can work things out. But as it is right now, the politicians of the one political entity, Newburgh, are able to beat up on the politicians of the county, while the citizens in this area sit back and watch their property rights dwindle away. I thank you for your time and attention. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, I want to address two things.
Identify yourself for the record once more, please.
My name is Tom Bunn. I'm the Yamhill County Commissioner. I wanted to address two points that were brought up by the previous speakers. It was said that the agreement between the city and the county is a land use decision and can be appealed within 21 days. I disagree with that. It is just what it is. It's an agreement. It's a contract between the city and the county, and it specifically provides that either party, by giving notice within a certain period of time, may opt out. The city of Newburgh did opt out, and it's my belief that the agreement is no longer in effect. It was also said that the city of Newburgh has requested to keep the agreement in effect for 90 days so that they can negotiate with us. I believe that they don't have the right anywhere under our agreement to do that after they've already given notice, and the deadline was July 1st, and the agreement is no longer in effect, in my opinion. And so I just want to state for the record that's what I believe, and I believe that's the position of the Board of Commissioners.
May I say one other thing, and that is, this is not just something that is an effect for the, you know, this county of Yamhill and the area around Newburgh. This situation has arisen, could arise under your present law and regulation in any other area of the state. So I think that the idea of taking care of it through just and even legislation would be the way to deal with it.
Thank you very much. We have been in a public hearing, a closed public hearing in the work session.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Tarnow.
I think that this issue needs to be discussed and moved along in the written process, but I also agree that Mr. Indy, that he needs an opportunity to talk to his counsel within LCDC, but I think the bill needs to get going because of the short time frame. So I'm going to move Senate Bill 1335 to the floor.
With the due pass?
The due pass recommendation.
Senator Tarnow has moved Senate Bill 1335 to the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Charter.
Aye.
Senator Wilde.
Aye.
Aye. I received necessary majority. Senate Bill 1335 moves forward to pass recommendation. Senator George will carry. Show the other committee members as excused. That we conclude our business for the day and adjourn the committee on public affairs.